MacCast, Sunday, April 24th, 2011. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back. I have a good show for you this week. We're going to be talking about Apple's second quarterly results call. The numbers are in, and they are great. Probably not a much of a surprise there. Redesigned iPhone 5 being rumored, so it might look a little bit different than we were originally expecting. Also, some folks spotted a white iPhone in the wild, might be shipping soon, believe it or not. I'll believe it when I see it, I think. Possible refresh of some Mac models, and then there's location gate. I almost called it antenna gate. Location gate. There always seems to be some sort of gate or scandal going on. This time around, it's GPS tracking on your iPhone. Do you need to be worried about it or not? Also, some updates on the iTunes cloud, along with your comments and questions. Someone wanted to know about my paperless workflow. I'll be getting into that, along with using iWeb for your business. And some tips and tricks, a review of the Magic Wand, which is a really cool device from the folks over at 12 South. And since it is a holiday, I'm going to be throwing in an Easter egg for you. So if you celebrate that sort of thing or just want a special treat, I have that for you in this episode. Before we get into that, I do want to take a moment, thank one of my show sponsors, Smile, makers of Text Expander. If you haven't checked out Text Expander, it's one of those applications that I rely on each and every day. Really simple in what it does, but very powerful when you start to use it. Basically, what you can do is you can define little snippets, little abbreviations that when you type them into your Mac, they expand out larger blocks of text that you add into the program. They also have pre-canned snippets that come with the app and things that you can download. One of my favorites is the HTML snippets because I'm a web programmer. I can have basically what amounts to HTML autocomplete in every application. It's throughout the OS. I don't have to rely on a specific application or developer putting that into their app. They also have this really cool set of accented words and symbols. So if you're finding you're having to hunt and peck for those things, you don't need to worry about that anymore. You just type the word normally and the autocomplete will take care of putting in all those accents for you. And also you can take those snippets with you onto your iOS devices because they have Text Expander Touch for iOS. It syncs across your snippets back and forth so you can easily move them, have them everywhere that you'd like to use them. And the reason is, if you're thinking, well, iOS, wouldn't you need to have background processing or something happening in the background? The folks at Smile were really clever because they made an API available to other developers, and many of the very popular applications that a lot of people use, a lot of us use, have Text Expander built in through that API. They have a great list on their website. So if you want to check out the products, if you want to get more information, they have trials of the desktop applications available. You can head over to smilesoftware.com and get all of the details. And a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. So on Wednesday, Apple held its second quarterly results call, the second quarter of 2011, and the numbers were spectacular once again. They had record second quarter revenue of $24.67 billion with a net profit of $5.99 billion, so just under $6 billion, just by a tiny hair. International sales, interestingly, accounted for about 59% of the quarter's revenue, so Apple is doing very well outside the U.S. Mac sales were up 27%. Apple sold 3.7 million Macs in the quarter. They did note in the Q&A after that the MacBook Air and the recent MacBook Pro refresh really helped a lot in boosting Mac sales for the quarter. They also were up 113% year over year on iPhone sales. So the iPhone 4 still doing really, really well. 18.65 million units sold in the quarter. Now, not everything was totally bright and shiny. iPod sales were down 17%. Apple sold 9.02 million units. So iPods declining. Still, the iPod Touch makes up a third of those iPod sales, excuse me. And then Apple sold just 4.69 million iPads for the quarter. Now, that's down from 7 million iPads sold in the prior quarter, and a lot of analysts were expecting numbers around the 7 million. I even heard as high as 9 million units as a prediction for the second quarter. So they definitely came in under on those numbers. Now, you have to remember when you're doing the comparison that they were coming off a really strong holiday quarter, and there was probably a lot of anticipation from people with the iPad 2 being launched, people holding off on those iPad 1 sales, and then we know that the iPad 2 had constrained supplies. So they said several times during the call that they couldn't get, or they were, you know, really struggling to meet iPad 2 demand. It was a lot higher, I think, than they were expecting. As for what was causing the delays or the shortages, Apple doesn't go into that sort of thing, but iSupply says it's likely due to display shortages and shortages on speaker components. The rumors of display shortages are likely to be true because I did hear this week that Apple added a couple new display component suppliers. So that's probably to ramp things up and meet the demand. Tim Cook said in the Q&A afterwards that they were confident Apple was going to be able to produce large numbers of the iPad 2 in the third quarter, and even said they're bringing on 13 more countries for iPad 2 sales. So they must be pretty confident if they're going to be launching into a bunch of new markets. And they, you know, still 1-2 week delays on online orders of iPad 2s, but Apple rushing to get those units out and have a really great third quarter. Other thing I noted from the conference call, iTunes generated $1.4 billion in revenue. So revenue going up on iTunes, things might be paying off a little bit. It was noted that most of that revenue came from iOS app sales. So apps, very popular, iOS devices, very popular, and Apple's making a little bit of profit now off that 30%. iTunes never really generated that much revenue for Apple before, but it's definitely on the rise. And overall, Apple just had another spectacular quarter, really beating out the rest of their peers in the industry in terms of sales, computer sales being up year over year, quarter after quarter. So that's great to see. We've been hearing a lot of rumors about the upcoming iPhone 5. Most recently, the rumors have been focused on a delay on when we'll actually see that unit. Apple typically delivers new iPhones in the summer, in June. It's sounding like we're not going to see the hardware until the fall, but we haven't heard a lot about the design, if Apple's really going to change it very radically. In the past, a lot of the rumors have been saying that it's not a radical change. It's mostly going to be some component upgrades. Well, this week in a blog post from Engadget's Joshua Topolsky, he says that there is going to be a significant design change, and they even mocked up a version of the iPhone based on some of the information that they were getting. They're saying it's going to be redesigned, looking more like an iPod Touch with the metal back. Also, it's going to be tapered in terms of the thinness, so going from thick to thin, top to bottom, much like the profile of the MacBook Air. It's going to have those rounded edges like the iPad 2, and they are backing up the prior rumors that we heard that the screen is going to get larger, going edge to edge, Apple eliminating almost all of the bezel around the edge of the screen. They're saying that's going to allow them to put in about a 3.7-inch screen. Some people had quoted a 4-inch screen, but just slightly under. That will adjust the pixel density down a little bit. So the current iPhone 4's Retina display has 326 pixels per inch. They're saying the new screen would be about 312 pixels per inch, but still technically Retina by Apple's standards, which I guess, according to them, is anything over 300 pixels per inch. They say at 12-inch viewing distance, you cannot see or distinguish the individual pixels at that distance, and that's sort of Apple's marketing qualifications for Retina. They're able to do that, according to the report, because Apple is using new bonding techniques or experimenting with new bonding techniques in the display that'll allow them to get rid of that that bezel. In the mock-up, what they're showing is the bezel being eliminated mostly on the sides. You're still going to have the area where you have the earpiece and then the area for the home button. But according to the report, the home button is getting a little bit of an update too, making it an actual gesture area and possibly slightly a little bit larger, the button being physically larger. Most of the reports we've been hearing in the past said that the button was going to get smaller or be eliminated completely. Probably not eliminated, but becoming a touch point. which will be interesting. I'm not sure exactly how that would work. It would obviously require some software changes. Now, the Worldwide Developer Conference is coming up, and typically Apple will show off the OS, both Lion and new version of iOS. That's still expected to happen, but I would imagine they're not going to talk about any new software features that might be related to hardware changes. So still a rumor at this point. This report also reconfirms the rumors we'd been hearing that Apple's been playing with near field communications technology, but adds in something I hadn't heard anybody mention before, that Apple's also experimenting with doing wireless charging in the new device. I'm not sure how good that technology is yet, but the basic concept is you'd have a surface or something you could throw the iPhone onto, and it would actually charge without actually having to plug it into a physical cable. Something else that Apple should be updating is the wireless chipset in the new device, moving to a true global chipset, the ones from Qualcomm. I think they're called Gobi chips. Basically, they do dual GSM and CDMA in one chip, meaning Apple's not going to have separate devices, so we're not going to have all these different models for the different regions and carriers and stuff like that. You'll have one device and it'll be able to connect to either GSM or CDMA. That'll be a nice addition. I think the iPhone 4 on Verizon has a chipset like that, but it's only enabled on the CDMA side, at least some, according to some of the reports that I've read or some of the teardowns that I've looked through. Now, one thing that the piece does point out, and I think this is important to note, all of this is based on alleged reports from people seeing prototype units that are out in testing in the wild. So you can kind of take this as specs and features are subject to change. Apple does a lot of experimenting with different technologies. They do a lot of field testing of this stuff. And while Engadget has been fairly accurate, I think that's why we end up with a lot of these rumors being hit and miss. Some come to be, some end up being cut at the last minute, and Apple rejiggers things, and what we get in an actual hardware device, we really won't know until Apple tells us and we announce it. But it's still fun to speculate and kind of figure out what Apple might be up to. It's kind of fun thinking about this stuff. The one thing that a lot of people want to happen that I think isn't going to happen is LTE. I wouldn't expect LTE support until next year, until 2012 at the earliest. Apple still really isn't happy with the chipset performance, and it was basically reiterated in the quarterly results call by Tim Cook, saying that, you know, Apple has specific requirements for the chip design when they move to LTE, and they keep reevaluating, but they have not been happy with it. The chips require design changes, is what Apple says, that they're just really not willing to make. Apple wants one single chip that's going to be able to do not just 4G, but also 3G, have that backward compatibility. And I guess the current chipsets that are out there, at least according to what I read, would require two chips for backward compatibility, which is why some of the 4G phones that you've seen out there are a little larger. And Apple keeps trying to make things thinner. If the design changes they're talking about in this report are true, that tapered edge is all about just having it thinner, at least on one side, if you can't get it on both because you need certain ports. And obviously up by the headphone jack, I think we've kind of reached the limit. If you look at your iPhone 4, it's about as wide on the top as that 1/8-inch jack. So they'd have to move to some other adapter or dongle, and I don't think anybody really likes that. I like my standard 1/8-inch jack. But looks like some design changes on the way for the iPhone 5. It'll be fun to see when Apple actually throws it out and gives us a peek at it. Something at least one Apple fan in the UK may have gotten a peek at before anybody else is Apple's official white iPhone 4. Apple has said they would be shipping the white iPhone in the spring, so they're quickly running out of time. And Engadget posted a picture of what they claim is a white iPhone sold by Vodafone in the UK. There was a memo that reportedly went out right after that telling their resellers to stop selling the white iPhones. It's not supposed to be out there being sold. There were rumors prior to this of the white iPhone showing up in the inventory system for Vodafone, I think in the Netherlands, and it was labeled with an April 27th ship date or sale date. 9to5Mac was also reporting that the white iPhone showed up in the inventory system of Best Buy and has the same release date. This is something that we've seen happen before, where new devices show up in Best Buy. Seems to be a big source of leaks for new devices, and pretty accurate when it comes down to that. The employees are willing to send out screenshots of the devices showing up in their inventory system. So it does sound like the white iPhone is going to be going on sale next week. So if you've been holding out for that one, your wait might be finally over. Now, the one thing that is in the image that was released by Engadget to note is that there does appear to be, if this is the actual unit, there does appear to be a slight design change related to the proximity sensor. In the original photos that we saw, the proximity sensor just had little perforated holes that the sensor worked through. This one actually has a full slit that kind of sits right under the earpiece. So it makes you wonder if that was one of the things they were struggling with in terms of getting performance to work with the white, if there was some issues with the proximity sensor. Definitely, if this image turns out to be true, there was a design change made for some reason. So that's worth noting. And then lastly, another version of the iPhone 4 might also be surfacing. Late this week or over the weekend, we heard that Apple is field testing some iPhone 4 units on the T-Mobile network in the States. That didn't seem that surprising to me. I figured once Apple released the iPhone on a carrier's outside of AT&T that they'd be moving to put that in on some other carriers, although now it may be a moot point because AT&T's in a bid to buy T-Mobile. So might see the iPhone show up on T-Mobile and then quickly be rolled into the new AT&T network. But needless to say, there are some rumors that Apple's doing some field testing on those units. And let's not leave the Macs out of the rumor mix. 9to5 has rumors that resellers are getting notices saying that iMac supplies are constrained and expect a little longer lead time in getting refreshes of inventory. That typically is a sign that Apple's getting ready to produce some new models. It was also noted that Apple's online store in the UK dropped the ship time on the lower end iMac, the 21.5-inch iMac, down to 2 to 3 days. I did an inventory check on the US. It was still showing 24-hour ship times on all of the iMacs. So I'm kind of taking this one with a grain of salt, but the refresh is expected to bring the new Sandy Bridge processors to the lineup along with Thunderbolt ports. So this would just be a slight rev to bring it up to date with some of the latest technologies. And that seems to be what's happening across the board with these rumors, because there were also rumors that Apple may be getting ready to update the MacBook Air as early as June. They would be throwing in the ultra low or low voltage Core i5 and i7 processors, those Sandy Bridge processors, and also adding Thunderbolt ports to those models. And just for good measure, let's not leave out the Mac Pro. 9to5 is also reporting that Apple is getting ready to rev that, although this one might be getting a case redesign. They say there's a prototype out there that Apple's redesigning the case to fit into a rack system to serve as a server. You remember that Apple did discontinue the X-Serve, so there's some validity to Apple maybe trying to help IT professionals get these things into their racks, although not going to be quite as space efficient. The X-Serve was a 1U unit. They're saying this redesigned case will be designed to fit into about a 3U rack, and that would also get the same kind of revisions that the other models are undergoing: Thunderbolt ports, new processors. The one other change, though, with the Mac Pros is they're looking at some stacked drive designs, so you could actually get more drive density into those units, packing in more storage, which is something that's going to be critical for server installations. So new Macs on the way, sounding like we're going to see some models getting some refreshes this summer. And now, are you ready for the next iScandal? We had AntennaGate. Well, now you can welcome in LocationGate. The press had a field day with this one this week. It was the big, big news story. In essence, some researchers, I think the folks over actually at O'Reilly, discovered that there is a text file that is on your iOS devices, and it's also synced over when you do your backup to your Mac. It's unencrypted, and it contains location data that can be used through some software, through a simple program that they wrote that you can download. So you can see all of the location history, the coordinates and GPS locations of the places that you've gone with your iPhone. So a spouse or a private investigator, somebody who could get hold of this file, could figure out where you've been and when you've been to that place. Now, that's the hype, that's the hysteria. Let's break it down a little bit and talk about what the realities are and how much or how little you need to be concerned about this. And it's not, I'm not going to discount it completely, but let's get the facts because, you know, a lot of stuff gets thrown out in the press and you hear different reports from different locations. And we always try and break it down here on the MacCast and kind of get to the meat of the issue. So what's going on here is your iPhone, as it's moving around, does collect data from cell towers and Wi-Fi hotspots, and then stores that data in a SQLite file that is on the phone. And this is the file that they've discovered and that they parse through with their software to kind of show these locations. So it has timestamps, has location information. I hadn't read if it has a unique identifier. I don't think that's in there. I've looked at this file before, but it's been a little while since I took a look at it. That file is included in your iPhone backup, so when you do sync that back to your iTunes, it's in there. The file is unencrypted, so it can be read. It can be extracted from that backup using some other software or directly off of the device itself if you jailbreak and if the device isn't encrypted. But the reality is this file's not new. It's actually been there for a while. I'm not sure if Apple's changed what they're doing with the data, but back in 2010, about a year ago, in July of 2010, a couple of senators, Republican Edward Markey and Joe Barton, who's a Republican from Texas, Markey from Massachusetts, actually queried Apple and asked them to respond to questions about how Apple was using this data. And they responded back then. They were using the data starting with iOS 3.2. Apple started collecting this data to build a database of the known cell phone tower locations and Wi-Fi hotspot locations. They were going to use this information to build out location services in the phone. Prior to Apple actually collecting the data themselves, they were using a database from Skyhook Wireless, you remember? So like iPod touches, that's how they get their geolocation data, is through knowing where these Wi-Fi hotspots are. And Apple bought that data from Skyhook and Google in the past, and then they started building out their own database using this information that was collected on your phone, and then it was batched together, encrypted, and sent to Apple every 12 hours when you were connected to Wi-Fi. And I don't know if you remember that. It didn't get much play back then, but certainly getting a lot of play now. And I will reiterate, I don't know if Apple is changing how they're using this information. I'm assuming they're using it in the same way, that it's batching it up, and about every 12 hours or so, it's being sent to Apple. So what is actually in the data? Well, it's not exact GPS coordinates of what or where your phone has been. It's the GPS coordinates of the cell towers and the Wi-Fi hotspots that you've connected to. Now, you could use that information to kind of triangulate, but it's not specific exact locations. And I think that's something to note. I don't know that it belays the privacy concerns people have, but it is an important detail. Now, obviously, at this point, the information is stored on your phone. It's in this unencrypted file. And as to why it might be there, well, we can only speculate, but the common sense thing says that Apple puts it there for caching reasons, because location-based apps use this information. And to turn on the chipsets and use the GPS to actually connect to cell towers and stuff like that eats up a lot of battery. So if you've already been in a location, why not cache that, have that locally? Now, some people are going to argue, well, why can't Apple simply encrypt that file so that people can't get to it? And as you'll find out, they kind of do in a way. And the other thing to note is that it did come out, and I was expecting this when I saw these reports starting to surface earlier in the week. I said, you know what? Someone's going to come out and say Android and the other phones do the same thing or have similar files. And it turned out to be true. Android has similar files. They're a little bit harder to access because you do need to root the device, which is the same thing as jailbreaking. Now, that's similar with the iPhone because you have to jailbreak the iPhone if you want to get this file off the device itself. I guess with Android, you can only get it directly off the device. It's not synced back to your computer. So it's a little bit easier to access in Apple's case, because once you've synced over to iTunes, you can kind of get into that backup file using some simple software on your Mac and get to it. But the point remains the same. They're both collecting the data. Google is, and Android is also sending that data back to Google's servers. And in Google's case, it was proved they're passing a unique identifier. So that could be used to get back to the device itself. I'm not saying it is, but it potentially could. So security experts are kind of having a field day with all of this information. They really feel that Apple, or some of them at least, feel that Apple should be encrypting this data and protecting users. Now, one thing we need to point out is that the terms of service that Apple has for the iPhone, and I recognize nobody reads this stuff, but here's the problem. In the terms of service, Apple says, and I'm going to read the whole thing. I don't typically read terms of services, but I think this is important to give perspective on this issue. So it says, Apple and its partners and licensees may provide certain services through your phone that rely upon location information. To provide and improve these services where available, Apple and its partners and licensees may transmit, collect, maintain, process, and use your location data, including the real-time geographic location of your phone and location search queries. The location data and queries collected by Apple are collected in a form that does not personally identify you and may be used by Apple and its partners and licensees to provide and improve location-based products and services. And it goes on and on and on like that. But you can see, by agreeing to the terms of services of using a phone, you've agreed that Apple is going to collect this information, that they're going to share it. And I think it is important to note that they point out specifically in there that it's not personally identifiable. And that's going to be the ultimate thing. When this all plays out, this is going to be the thing that Apple is going to have to prove to regulators and to the people who are concerned about this, that there's no way to, you know, personally identify you in this information. Now, some people are concerned that predators and nefarious people could get a hold of this information, kind of get a good idea. Again, they're not going to be have the exact GPS coordinates, but they're going to get a good idea of where you've been and when you've been in those locations. And they could use that if they can see, oh, you're gone from work, at work during these hours. This might be a good time to break in. Now, that's the sort of big concern. What's my opinion? And this is just my opinion I'm sharing with you now. I think this has got way blown out of proportion. I think it isn't that personal of data, but more importantly, someone actually needs physical access to your device and some moderate skills and intermediate skills to actually get to and extract the information and figure out what's going on there. And I think it's ultimately our responsibility to protect ourselves. So if you password code, or if you passcode lock your iPhone, and especially with the new iPhone devices, the 3GS and the iPhone 4, that's going to encrypt the data on the device. And once that data is encrypted on the device, you can't get to it. You can't break in and get to that with the encryption turned on. And you should be doing the same thing on your Mac. You should be passcode locking your Mac so someone can't get in and get to your files. And Apple also gives you the ability to encrypt your iPhone backup file. So if you go into the settings, you can encrypt the iPhone backup file, and that's going to protect this data inside the backup. And that's where I think the easiest place to get the data out of would be out of that backup file. So I'm still a little unsure of the data being sent to Apple, what they're using it for. I do think they need to explain and reiterate that it doesn't and still doesn't contain any identifying data, just like they did in 2010. It's also important to note that iAds, Apple's ad service, uses separate data that gets sent out, and that gets sent out to advertisers and third-party companies unless you opt out of that. If you remember, Apple had a way to opt out through their website, and I think in the device you can actually turn it off in the location services area. There's an on-off switch for the data that iAds might send out. So if you're concerned about that, you probably should block that. Apple's lack of an official response so far, I think, is the biggest problem for them with this location gate story. It's not really showing good faith, and it does make it seem like they're trying to hide something or they're kind of scrambling. So I think they need to respond quickly. If they don't respond early next week, this is going to just continue to be an issue. And it certainly does conflict with Steve Jobs' public statements about respecting people's privacy when it comes to location. He's been really adamant about that. So I think a layer of transparency, yes, it's in the terms of service, but nobody reads that, right? So it's not really transparent to people that this is going on, and Apple's going to have to be a little more upfront and public about that. If you do want to see what kind of information is in there, I'll have a link to this iPhone tracker application. It's really easy to run. Which I think is also part of the reason why so many people jumped on this story, is you can simply run this little iPhone tracker app on your Mac or PC and see all these location points. But I think what you'll see is it's not really specific, but you know, still, we got to look at both sides of the coin here, and we do want to be able to control our own privacy. I think we still can, but we need to be more proactive about it and aware of it. And I think this is really what it comes down to, is this awareness and transparency. So we'll have to see how this plays out next week, but that's what's going on, and that's my opinion on it. And then finally this week, it sounds like Apple's getting closer to finishing up what it needs to do for the iTunes cloud services. Eddie Q, Apple's Vice President of Internet Services, he's basically the guy in charge of iTunes and MobileMe. He was reportedly in New York City on Friday to close some streaming deals with the labels. This information comes from D All Things Digital. Apple reportedly already has an agreement in place with Warner Music Group and is likely to sign EMI next. They're also going to have to do deals with Sony and Universal. Apple plans, or the rumor is that Apple's planning on offering some sort of cloud storage service for the music that you purchase through iTunes. Apple needs the deals because currently the music industry requires a royalty payment every time a track is downloaded or streamed. They actually, it's interesting because they make no distinction between streaming or downloads. They're kind of the same thing under the licensing. And I think that's something that Apple's trying to change. They reportedly successfully argued that a download, or what they're doing with their cloud initiative, would be like storing a backup and then therefore shouldn't be controlled under those performance rights and they shouldn't have to pay a royalty again. We know Amazon recently launched their cloud storage service, but it's slightly different than what Apple's reportedly trying to do. With Amazon, when you make the purchase, they're actually just making a copy of that track into the cloud, and they did not work deals with the music labels or the record industry, and they're actually getting some flack for that right now. Apple's trying to make these agreements up front because what they'd like to do, or what they reportedly like to do, is be able to just have the copy that they already have that's served up for iTunes and then just give you access to re-download that. So a very minor distinction between the two things they're trying to do, but significant in terms of licensing and deals with the record labels. So hopefully Apple's able to finish those up, and it sounds like they're wooing the executives. They're going through the motions, and hopefully Eddie Q made some progress this week, because I'm really looking forward to getting some sort of cloud storage. The fact that I have to worry about backing up all the stuff that I buy through iTunes, frankly, keeps me from buying specifically movies. I'd like to see Apple do a similar thing with movies and television shows as well, and I think they're going to try and do the whole deal before they actually launch an iTunes cloud initiative. Right now, it's sounding like it would be the fall at the earliest, which would make sense. That's typically when Apple launches new iPods and we hear news about updated versions of iTunes and services and stuff like that. So that'd be a great addition to that event in September, I think, is usually when they do that. If not, it might be 2012. It's hard to get all these deals done. So Apple's working hard at it. Let's hope they make some good progress. So this time of year is a time when a lot of us are trying to get organized. Maybe we've just finished up doing our taxes. You're trying to get all your papers together, deal with all that stuff. And a topic that inevitably comes up is going paperless. I know I've mentioned it on the show a couple times, but I did get this voicemail from Brett.
Hi, Adam. My name's Brett. I heard on one of your shows once that you use a SnapScan, and ever since, or for some time, I've been curious about buying one of those SnapScans, basically going paperless, which I think a lot of people want to do. And what I currently have right now is I have an HP Pro 8500, which is pretty cool. It scans, prints, faxes, does everything. Challenge is it doesn't scan very well, and it certainly doesn't. It does duplexing, but it doesn't do both sides, which I know this ScanSnap does. What I like to do is I like to scan my documents, and then I've made a network drive, and basically they just pile up in there. Each new scan's a new file, and later on I go in there and label them. I'm curious on what your workflow is. I want something kind of brain dead simple, and you know, if it's simple, I'll do it. If it's too many steps, I unfortunately won't do it. I don't mind currently scanning to a network drive. I actually like that a lot, and going in at my leisure and cleaning it up every year, 90 days, whatever it ends up being. I'm curious what your workflow is, and with your experience with that SnapScan, if I could scan to a network drive without having to interface any software once it's set up. The way I currently do it is I just basically put a paper in there, hit this network scan, hit scan, it scans it to, basically ends up being my Drobo. I have a share on Snow Leopard server. Just trying to learn here. Anyway, I appreciate it. If we happen to get this on your show and you could teach us your workflow. I'm sure many people would appreciate it. Thanks for your show. Thanks for your time. And have yourself a great weekend. Stay cool. It's warm. Bye.
Yeah, Brett, it has been warm here in San Diego. I know other people in other parts of the world and in the country aren't as lucky with the weather. I mean, San Diego is always pretty nice, but I appreciate the question, and I'd be happy to go over what I do. It's very similar to, I think, the workflow that you've worked out for yourself. In the interest of disclosure, I do need to mention the ScanSnap that I have was one that was provided as a review unit from Fujitsu. You can use any scanner. Yeah, you mentioned you have an all-in-one scanner there. Not as convenient as something that does the duplexing. Also, Neat, the Neat company makes some good solutions as well that you might want to check out. I'll have links to all of those in the show notes at mattkast.com. So the unit that I have is the S300M, and it does do the duplexing. So when you run the scan through, it'll scan both sides at the same time. It does auto correction and stuff like that. You're asking more about the workflow. I've done reviews of the scanner before, so if you want to go back and listen to those, you can. Really nice units. I also was able to test an S1100, which is their new ultra portable one, which is a really other nice unit. But I use the SnapScan Manager. So the SnapScans come with a piece of software that you run on your Mac. And when that's running, you can set up basically these profiles. And they have some built-in ones. There's built-in software that comes if you want to scan directly to a Word document or Excel document. They have the Abby Fine Reader software that's bundled with it. They also have the ability now with the new version of the software to actually scan directly to Evernote if you use Evernote for your document management. And that's really nice because it'll sync up to the cloud and then can sync to your iOS devices. Also, you can scan right into Google Docs if you do that sort of thing. But I'm pretty much simpler than that. I'm just scanning straight to PDFs. It'll also scan to JPEGs if that's an option that you want to use. And I am actually having everything flow into the Neatworks software. So I am actually kind of using a hybrid solution. I use the Fujitsu scanner, but then the Neatworks software. And the reason for that is I just found it to be a really good document manager. And I'm just like you said, I'm somebody who wants something dead simple. I don't want to have to worry about it. I want to be able to kind of batch these things up, come back to it later, deal with the organization. And really the key for me with the Neatworks software is that it does the OCR. You can actually do OCR on the ScanSnaps. It has the built-in, as I mentioned, I think it uses also the Abby Fine Reader engine to do the OCR and basically make a searchable PDF. But I want the scans to go a little bit faster because I am batching these up. And Neatworks will go ahead and run the OCR in the background. And that means I can do a quick scan of my documents, have them dumped into Neatworks, and then come back later for the organization. So the general workflow is I'll get, you know, bills or whatever, I open them up, and I sort of pile them up on the input hopper of the ScanSnap. And then when it gets full, you know, it'll do 12, I think, 15 documents at a time. So sort of when that fills up, I know, hey, that's time. And it's usually about every week or so, time to scan everything in. And you could just push the button and they'll all scan in duplex and it'll do the auto correction. They'll go right into a single PDF document and then I could go back in and split that up in Neatworks. But I find that's a little tedious. So I'll actually just pull the documents off, separate them into the individual documents that I want to scan. So if I have a credit card statement, I'll scan that and then that'll go into one PDF file and then I'll do my next document and so on and so on. And then that all goes in. I have set up a custom profile because with the ScanSnap software, you can actually create profiles for having it go into any application on your Mac, really. Some have more features than others. This is pretty basic. It scans to a PDF and then dumps it right into Neatworks. So Neatworks will launch and then everything goes in Neatworks into the inbox. And then once it's in the inbox, it's sort of like iPhoto for your documents. So you can kind of think of that as just being dumped into your library. And they have three basic document types that you can define. And the only differences between them really are the default fields or metadata that you can then assign to those documents. So they have a document category, a receipt, or a contact, because it'll also allow you to scan business cards. But I let those go into the inbox. And then about once a month or so, I'll come back to that inbox and then start organizing. You can set up folders. So that's sort of like playlists in iTunes. I can categorize things. I have one folder for home stuff, one folder for my business stuff, and then subfolders for all kinds of different categories like insurance and what have you. And so I'll go in there. Everything's stored in a single DB file. Again, just like iTunes, you know, you have your iTunes library file. I'll have my Neatworks file. And that's really good because it can be backed up. And I actually, for added security, I put mine on an encrypted disk image that's stored on my Mac. So I create an encrypted disk image. That's a little less convenient because when I go to do my scanning or when I launch Neatworks, I have to remember to mount that disk image and plug in my password. But you can set that up if you want to have that automatically come up when you start up your Mac. I wouldn't recommend saving the password. Just have it prompt you for the password, a little more secure. But stored that one file on there, and that way I know it's encrypted, and that data, no one can get it if my Mac were to get stolen or something like that. But as I said, it OCRs everything. And what's really nice is once you've applied metadata to certain types of documents, it seems to recognize, and I haven't been able to dive into the details, but what I noticed is that if I've done, say, my bank statement and it knows that it's already OCR'd and that is Chase, who is my bank, the next time I scan one of those statements, it'll automatically fill in that into the title information and start filling out some of the metadata information that I've already assigned before. Another really neat thing that it has is it has support for categories like tax categories. So it's starting now to recognize receipts that I have that are repeating and even applying the right tax category for, say, my Schedule C's for my taxes and stuff like that to that. And it puts all that in the Neatworks metadata. And it can also recognize totals. So it'll scan in and it recognizes the totals and fills those out. And what's great about that is once I've organized stuff into folders, I can click on individual folders. So say for my business, I have a travel expenses folder. I can click on that folder and then down in a pane, an info pane at the bottom, it'll give me the total amounts that are in that folder, the total sales tax that's in that folder, and the number of documents. So it's a real quick summary to go back in there and have that information. Of course, all this stuff is searchable with like a spotlight search. It's really fast. That makes it really easy to recall and find documents again. And it gets all backed up and is stored securely in that disk image. So that's really what I'm doing. I'm just scanning once a week, coming back and cleaning up and adding in the metadata and organizing things about once a month. And it's really helped keep my documents under control. And then what's great is now, rather than, you know, I used to have all these files and folders in a filing cabinet and you keep all the stuff organized that way. Now that I'm doing all that digitally, all I have is I have a box each year for all of my documents. So I have a box, a little file box labeled 2011. After I do my scanning, I throw the original documents in there. At the end of the year, that box will go out into the garage and I'll set up a new one, you know, for long-term storage, and I'll set up a new one. So, and people have asked me, why do I keep the paper? Because I know some people destroy the paper. I'm just paranoid about this stuff. Even though I have triple backups of all my digital data, I just want to know that if I ever need to go back and get one of those original documents for any reason, it's there. And I think that IRS and the tax people require that you keep these documents. I don't think they specify whether it has to be digital or physical, but I'm overly paranoid about that stuff. So I use the Neatworks software as document management. There are other great document management software. There's other great document management software out there that you can get. I know a lot of people really like Yojimbo from Barebones. Reinvented Software. I actually use their software feeder for doing my RSS feed for the podcast, but they have a great application called Together. That's a document manager. And Mariner Software has one called Paperless. So lots of options out there for management. You don't have to use Neatworks. It's just the one I discovered at Macworld a few years ago, and it's fit well into my workflow. So I hope that helps answer your questions, and good luck with organizing your documents. Next, I received a question from Robert, and it was really interesting because it's about iWeb, and a lot of people use iWeb or recommend iWeb for real basic, simple, personal websites. But what he was wondering is iWeb feasible for a small business website? And if so, how would you actually get that up on the web? Or how do you actually use iWeb to create a website? And, you know, I have to say, before we get into this, iWeb was not updated in the latest update to Apple's iLife suite. So I don't know what that means for the future of the product. And it is pretty basic in terms of the functionality, but you can get advanced with it if you really want to dive in. I tend to find and I'm probably biased because I'm a web developer, that once you've reached the limitations of iWeb, you can kind of hack stuff in there, but it's like a lot of Apple's tools. Once you start going outside of the box of the functionality they give you and build in, you're kind of on your own when it comes to updates or when things start to break or go wrong because you've tweaked the software. It really makes it more difficult to deal with. So at that point, I usually recommend you move up to a more quote-unquote professional tool. That's not to say you can't do really professional high-end websites with iWeb, because if you've ever heard of the blog Roughly Drafted, they have a lot of great posts and articles on technology and Apple stuff. If you haven't checked it out, you should, roughlydrafted.com. But they actually ran their site, and it was a major site, on iWeb through 2007. I think they've since moved onto WordPress for, I think, some of the reasons that we're going to mention here, but you would have not known it was an iWeb site with the kind of work they had done to it. And Apple's added some tools that allow you to go pretty far with iWeb. So I think you could, if you had a real basic website that you needed set up for your small business, maybe an about page, maybe a couple pages with information on what you do, you could even get into e-com stuff, but I think at that point you really want to move onto something else. But if you're just doing maybe some online sales through a PayPal or a Google checkout, something like that, and certainly could work. I would say there's kind of three areas you need to look at. You need to look at design, and Apple offers a bunch of really nice built-in themes and templates. They have ones for blogs and galleries, welcome pages, about me pages, but they also have one that's just simply called blank. So you can start with a blank slate and start building out your navigation and building out your elements pretty easily all through drag and drop with the iWeb tools. If Apple's themes aren't really fitting the bill for you, there are also companies that make great third-party themes. There's a company called Jumpsoft.com or iPresentee.com, who have pretty nice libraries of different templates. And I think iPresentee actually has some business templates already out of the box. Now, the one thing to know about design with iWeb that is a little bit different, if you know anything about HTML development, all of the layouts are sort of static, absolutely positioned layouts. So when you put an element on the page, it's absolutely positioned with HTML. So if you need scalable or dynamic layouts that sort of go with the flow, so as someone makes their browser window larger, elements shift and move around, you might need another tool. Also, when you start adding widgets and different elements, it's important to know that if those things need to scale or expand, you're kind of looking at them through a window. And that brings me to the next thing. The elements that are built into iWeb do allow you a certain amount of customization. You can customize those designs. You have drop-in locations for images and elements. You can also add your own and define your own areas for text and images. Again, all absolutely positioned. And since iWeb 08, Apple added a functionality called widgets, which they have all kinds of canned widgets, things for inserting RSS feeds. So if you had a feed that you wanted to display on your page, you could plug in the RSS and drop that widget into place. Google Maps, if you wanted to have directions to your business, you could drop in the Google Maps widget and set the location and stuff like that. And those work really well and really nicely. And then when you get more advanced, they do have what's called a basic HTML widget. Dropping that on there allows you to actually add pure raw HTML code, and you can embed code from other sites. So if you've ever been to one of those sites that says, you know, put our widget on your site, and you fill out the form and then it gives you a block of HTML code, you can take that block and use the HTML widget in iWeb to put that on your website. Remembering now that it is going to be absolutely sized, so whatever the size of that window, your widget needs to fit inside that. And it's pretty smart about it. If you drop in say a video from YouTube, it'll actually recognize the dimensions on that and insert it at the right size. But you have to be careful not to scale it, because it's really easy to just grab the handles in iWeb and scale it down. If you scale it down, it might not work quite right, because it does need to be that absolute size. But overall, as I mentioned earlier, you can build some pretty sophisticated designs using the tools that are right there in iWeb. After you've got it all set up, you have all your pages together, you've linked things, you can link internally to pages, you can also link out externally with your menus and headers and footers and stuff like that. Once you have it looking the way you'd like, the next step is to publish. iWeb calls it publishing. You can just think of, you need to have a place to host your site. You still need to have hosting. You still need a way to get it out there on the web. The easiest way is probably to use your Mobile Me account, but you can use another hosting provider. iWeb does have support for publishing directly via FTP, so you can set up your FTP server settings and publish right to another provider. You can also publish to a local folder and then use a different FTP client or another method to get it up onto your hosting provider's servers. So you can use something like Transmit, or if your hosting provider offers a web uploader, uploading interface via web panel, you can use that. So just publish out to a local folder with iWeb and upload that way. If you do decide to use MobileMe, which is a great way to go, if you're not expecting a lot of traffic, MobileMe is a great starting point. I forget what their limits are currently set at, but you can do a fair amount of traffic with MobileMe and not go over the limits. And you can register your own domain. A lot of people don't know this, but you know, if you have a domain that registered with GoDaddy or Hover, one of those services, you can take that domain and you can have that pointed to your MobileMe account. All you have to do is register the domain, then point the DNS settings, the domain name service, at MobileMe. And you'll do that at your registrar's servers. So if you don't know how to do that, contact their support, ask them, or shoot an email. But you're going to point it at web.me.com. And then once you've done that, you'll log in to your account at me.com, go into the settings area, and then you'll see a section for adding your personal domain. Just click on that, you put in the domain information, and you should be good to go. And you can, no one will know that you're on MobileMe. It'll show your URL up there in the title bar, just like you were hosted any other place. So that's pretty much it. You can use iWeb to create a simple business website. And if you don't want to use iWeb, there are some great alternatives on the Mac. You might look into using software like Freeway. Freeway is very similar to iWeb in terms of it kind of hides the code. You don't need any code to build a website with Freeway. That's from SoftPress, softpress.com. If you want a tool that'll allow you to kind of have the best of both worlds, where you have a nice WYSIWYG editor, you might want to take a look at RapidWeaver. RapidWeaver has really nice themes, a big community around RapidWeaver. That's from RealMax Software. And the other thing is that you can, if you want to delve into the actual underlying code, you can get in there and tweak the code through RapidWeaver as well. You can kind of do that with iWeb, by the way. I probably should have mentioned this earlier. With iWeb, if you publish out to that folder, if you use the publish to a folder option, you can take the files that it generates, which is just HTML files, and you can open those up in an HTML editor and tweak things. The only thing there is, once you've done that, you're sort of left the safety and the confines of iWeb, and you're really on your own. Any updates you're going to want to do, you're going to have to make from that. Otherwise, if you go back to iWeb and publish back out to the folder, there's a good chance you're going to overwrite those changes, or you're going to need to reapply them. So you probably want to stick with Apple's tools to the point where you've gotten beyond what they can provide for you, and then maybe look at something else. If you want another way to go, there are great just online services now that'll allow you to quickly and easily set up a website. Squarespace is one of those. I've played around with it, and that they have great web-based tools for building a simple website, putting things together, and you can get pretty sophisticated with some of the stuff you can do on Squarespace. Also, WordPress. WordPress, a lot of people get confused. They don't know that WordPress offers two ways to use their software. They have an online hosted service with the software already pre-installed. So you get the web hosting, you can load your own domain on there, and you can have a WordPress site up and running very quickly. That's WordPress.com. There's also WordPress.org, and that is the open source software, or the software from WordPress, that you can download and put onto your own servers. And there you have to do a lot of configuration. You're going to have to know a little bit about database and PHP and stuff like that. And that's a different version of WordPress. So two versions. You might look at WordPress.com if you're looking to set up just a simple business website, that or Squarespace. And you don't want to use a software package on your Mac. So lots of options for building a small, simple business website. And Robert, I hope that helps get you started. Now I have a question from Bill. Bill was doing some stuff where he had to put a Mac into target disk mode and hook it up to another Mac, and then noticed some strange things going on, and had a question about that.
Hi, Adam. My name is Bill Thomason. I just ran into the strangest thing I've ever seen on a Mac. I have a PowerBook G4. I'm running Tiger 10.4.11. And I wanted to transfer some files to my wife's 27-inch Core i7 iMac. a bunch of pictures. So I copied over the files I wanted. This was entirely reading from the PowerBook's hard disk, no writing to it, and got the files transferred, no problem. It was a few gigabytes. And then I pressed the PowerBook's power button, and it shut down. A few minutes later, I restarted it because I wanted to check something on it. I went to Spotlight, and it said it was indexing with about, I swear it said, 21 hours remaining. Well, I closed the cover and took it back to the den where it lived so I could plug it back into its power so it could continue that process. And then when I opened it up in the den, it says only 2 hours remaining, and the progress indicator is moving about at a speed that would get it done in a couple hours, I think. But what I'm really curious about is this was my first time using target mode, and then afterwards Spotlight had to re-index the hard drive. Have you ever seen anything like that before? I'd be very curious.
Hey, Bill, you know what? I haven't, but I don't use target disk mode a lot. I have to say, though, after hearing your voicemail, it doesn't surprise me that that behavior happened. I probably should cover just connecting a Mac in target disk mode for anybody who doesn't know how to do that. In essence, what you can do is if you have a Mac and you'd like to mount that Mac's hard drive on another Mac, just as if it were an external drive, you can do that using a feature called target disk mode. You have to use a FireWire cable to do it, so you have to have a FireWire-based Mac, but you get the FireWire cable, you connect the two Macs together, and then you hold down the T key while starting up the Mac whose hard drive you want to mount on the other Mac, and that's called target disk mode. You'll know you've got it right when on the screen of the Mac that you're using as the external, you see the FireWire logo bouncing around on the screen. And then it should mount on the host Mac, and you can access the files just as if it were a hard drive. And that's key because I think, Bill, that's what happened. Spotlight, the way Spotlight works, is it's going to see any drive connected to a Mac, and it's going to try and build an index for that. Now, where I'm a little puzzled is your Mac, your MacBook Pro should have already had a Spotlight index on the hard drive. And the index is actually saved into a hidden file. I think it's actually a directory. Not sure exactly what's in there, but a hidden file called .spotlight-v100. And that is stored on the root, at the root level of the indexed volume. In this case, it would be the internal drive on your MacBook Pro. I'm guessing that when you connected it in target disk mode, though, that your wife's iMac saw that, went, oh, I need to index that new external drive, and blew away the index that was there before and started its own. And since you weren't connected to her Mac long enough for it to probably build the whole entire index, when you disconnected, same thing happened when you started the Mac back up. It went and looked for its version of the Spotlight index file, saw it wasn't there, saw it wasn't complete, and then started indexing again. The other oddity that you mentioned is something I think we've all seen before, and that's where the Mac sometimes does a terrible job at guesstimating time on progress indicators. So you saw it was going to say, it said it was going to take 27 hours or however many hours, and then, you know, a few minutes later, it's sort of reassessed itself and decided, oh yeah, it's only going to take me 2 hours to do this index. I've seen that with copying files too. When you first start copying a file, it'll jump up and it'll say, oh, about a week, and then 4 days, and then 2 hours, and then 30 minutes, and it'll kind of level out, but it needs to be running for a little bit of time. So my guess is that that is what was going on. You actually can force a rebuild of your Spotlight index too. So if you've ever tried to do some Spotlight searches and you notice things aren't exactly coming up as you would expect them, and you think there might be some problems with your index file, you can actually force that to be rebuilt. Now, it's a long process, so I generally recommend if someone wants to rebuild their Spotlight database, they plan on doing it overnight. So kind of set it up, start or force the rebuild right before you go to bed and just leave the Mac on overnight. But a couple ways you can do it, you can go into your system preferences, into the Spotlight preferences, and then simply add the volume that you want to re-index to the privacy list. Adding it to the privacy list means you're telling it, don't index this volume. When you do that on a volume that's already been indexed, it's going to blow away that file, that Spotlight V100 file, and then when you take it back off of the privacy list, so add it to the privacy list and then remove it from the privacy list, when you do that, it'll start rebuilding that index file. You can also use some third-party tools like Cocktail or Onyx. They have features built into them that just, you know, you say, okay, go ahead and rebuild the Spotlight index, because actually you can issue a terminal command. So if you're the type of person who isn't afraid of opening up the terminal and doing some command line operations, there actually is a command line that you can put in to force the reindexing of Spotlight. And I'll have that information in the show notes at mattcast.com if you want to look it up, or you can just simply Google for it. But I think that's what's going on, and that's a little bit about how to use target disk mode and how to rebuild Spotlight indexes. Now I want to tell you guys about a really cool product that I got to try out. And I saw this, it was announced several months ago, and it was one of those things, like, once you saw this product, you went, yes, that makes absolute sense, and I can't believe somebody didn't do this before. It's the Magic Wand from 12 South. They sent me one of them to try out, and it is a device that marries your Apple wireless keyboard and Apple's new Magic Trackpad. If you look at those two products from Apple, they look like they were two things that were separated at birth. They look like they just want to go together. It's sort of like a Reese's. It's like peanut butter and chocolate. They want to be melded, and now you can actually reunite them as they were maybe intended to be, or at least as they want to be. And what's great about this accessory is it's just really simple, but it's elegant. It's in essence a long plastic bar, same color, same silver color as the aluminum of the Magic Trackpad and the wireless keyboard, but then it has this channel in it, and you just snap the keyboard and the trackpad into that channel, and you can have the trackpad on either side, so it's good for left or right-handed, or even better yet, I tried it out. I have a Magic Mouse, so I'm right-handed. I use the Magic Mouse in my right hand. I put the trackpad on the left and then the keyboard in the middle, and you've got a lot of multi-touch options and control options going on there with both of them. And I've read a couple other people who say that's a great way to work. So you can do the trackpad and the multi-touch for working with photos or in iPhoto, something like that, and then still have the mouse controls for doing your scrolling, and you've got the keyboard. And wow, you almost need three hands at that point, but that's a really cool way to operate. And what's really neat about the 12 South stuff is it's always really well designed. So it's not just that channel with the two things that snap in. There's actually, they call it an H-beam, a little piece that slides between so that you have a nice finished look to it. Comes with a little rubber T-pad that finishes off the top edge, and it just really looks seamless once it's done. And it's rigid and solid too. The two are held together, so you can actually pick them up. And if you wanted to use this, say, for a Mac Media Center, you could do that. You could have the thing on your lap in your living room, and you'd have the trackpad and be able to control everything while doing that. When I did my testing, it worked as advertised, really nice. They say, 12 South says in their documentation that trackpad clicks close to the seam can be a little bit more difficult, because if you know how the Magic Trackpad works, it's actually the whole device kind of pushes down, and the little rubber feet in the back is what actually makes the click. So since you've made a more rigid kind of device, longer device, by attaching the keyboard on one side, I guess it can be, you might have to press a little bit harder if you're tapping close to the edge. But I didn't have that problem when I was using it, and just a really cool looking product. Because it's so simple and it really did work so well, I really don't have any cons on this. The one, and if you want, you kind of have to stretch for this, the one that you might mention is that it is $29.99, which could be a little bit pricey for some people, but it provides a solution that I think a lot of people want, and it does it very elegantly, like all of the 12 South products. If you haven't checked out the company, you should head over to the website. They have some images of the Magic Wand up there if you want to see what it looks like, or you could look at your album art right now if you're listening on your iPod or you're in iTunes. I throw those into the MacCast Enhanced podcast stuff, so you can see what it looks like there, but they have more images on the website as well as more information, and you can check out all the other kind of cool products from 12 South. I've always liked the stuff that they do, so 12south.com is the place, and that's the Magic Wand. One thing that's funny about being a Mac geek and having worked on the Mac for so long is you start to get used to how things work, and you have software and you have things that you do on your Mac that you do every day that you sometimes overlook real obvious and helpful features that are built right into different applications or even into the OS itself. I received an email this week from someone who was looking for a feature that they had enabled in the past and then just couldn't remember how to turn it back on, but were telling some people about it because it's very useful. And that is the Finder path bar. You may or may not even know this is there, but in Snow Leopard, and I don't know when this was added, but it's at least there in Snow Leopard. So if you're on Snow Leopard and you've ever wanted to be looking at your Finder window and be able to quickly see the path or sort of the breadcrumb to where you're currently at, that is built into the OS. If you go in the Finder menu under View, there's an option that says Show Path Bar. If you already have it enabled, it's going to be grayed out and it's going to say Hide Path Bar. But once you've enabled that and turned it on, now at the bottom of every window, when you've selected an item, you will see the path, the full path to where that item is synopsized right there down at the bottom of the window. Really cool little trick. It's built in there and a lot of people miss it because I don't think it's turned on by default. There are some hacks too. If you want to take it a step further, you can actually put the full path in the title bar up at the top of the window. This requires a terminal hack, and I'll have that in the show notes at maccast.com, but you can put in one of those little commands that overwrites the defaults or enables the hidden settings that are available in some of the applications. Now, if you're afraid of the terminal, I'm not afraid of the terminal, but I like the convenience of having a GUI. There's a great tool that enables a lot of these terminal or system preference hacks, or preferences hacks, I guess I kind of call them, and that is Secrets. I've talked about Secrets on the show in the past. It's from Blacktree, the same folks that make the great utility, or made the great utility, Quicksilver. Quicksilver, by the way, is coming back, so if you're a Quicksilver fan, they open sourced the project. It had been kind of being maintained by, I think, a bunch of different people, and they're now getting better organized and putting that project back together, and it's getting some oversight, and I think we're going to see it making a comeback in a big way. But Blacktree also makes this cool system preference pane called Secrets, secrets.blacktree.com, and you can use a GUI to enable this feature as well, showing the path in the title bar. And then lastly, if you're just a terminal user in general, if you want to see the path when you're browsing through the terminal, there's a terminal command called PWD. So if you open up a terminal window and just type PWD, as in Delta, and hit Enter, it will display the current path for the current location you are in the terminal window. So there you go. Now you can know where you are, whether you're in the Finder or in the terminal, in a bunch of different ways. So lastly for today, because it is Easter Sunday, I figured I would give you all an Easter egg from the MacCast to you. And I'm not talking about the physical thing that you eat, although I'm sure plenty of us will eat plenty of those this weekend. What I have for you is OS X Easter egg, and there's lots of them in there. I've known about a few of them, but this one I had not run across before. So this is in the weather widget in your dashboard. So activate your dashboard and open up a new weather widget. You probably want to add a new one because this is going to mess up your location, because you can set the location to nowhere. Do you know where that is? Yeah, it's nowhere. The way you do it is put the weather widget on your dashboard and then hold down the command and the option key and click on the graphic, whatever image is right there. Hopefully it's a sun. In my case, it's almost always a sun, but click on the graphic, and it will change that graphic to another one of the weather graphics that the widget uses, and will also change the location to nowhere. And then command option clicking on that graphic will allow you to cycle through all of the different weather images that are available in the weather application. So some of those you may have never seen before. Like, I don't usually see the ones for snow flurries or snow living in Southern California. So I got to see those. A really cool one is the one for hail. And they also have one that I think is fog. That is the only animated one. I'm not sure why more of them aren't animated. It might be because they get a lot of fog in San Francisco, so they get a little special treatment up there in Cupertino with their weather graphics. But you can cycle through them, and I thought that was a really cool Easter egg. So enjoy that, and thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the show. Hopefully you had a great weekend and didn't overstuff yourself on the candy, and eat the ears first. It's the way to go. That's how I eat mine. That's going to do it for today. Before I leave you, I do want to thank all of my show sponsors. Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook. You can check out their software, get more information, as well as a trial over at circusponies.com. Smile, make sure you check out Text Expander Touch, but you can also take a look at all of their other applications on their site, smilesoftware.com, and they have demos available. And Furonics, makers of Deep Freeze and Fat Power Save Mac. You can check out the software, get more information and trials over at Furonics.com. Big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the show. If you want to get more MacCast, be sure to check out the MacCast member program. You can get information and details on that over at member.maccast.com. Just for a couple bucks a month, you can get some extra MacCast content and support the show at the same time. So I really appreciate that if you check that out. If you have any feedback for me, any comments, questions, maybe a review you want to send in, you can send those to maccast@gmail.com or call in on the listener hotline. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. You can leave a voicemail. Really easy. If you do, please leave your email address, and if you can spell it out for me, that's greatly appreciated. If you prefer to leave voicemail on Skype, my Skype address is TheMacCast. You can save on long-distance charges that way. And also be sure to check out the MacCast site. There I will have links to everything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast. MacCast.com is the site. And I'm posting more on Facebook these days, as I mentioned. Also Twitter, Facebook.com/TheMacCast, or on Twitter, Twitter.com/MacCast. And that'll do it for today. Have some new music for you. This time we're going to go techno. Comes from a MacCast listener, Tim. He sent this along. I'll have a link to his site up in the show notes at maccast.com. So if you want to check out more of his stuff, be sure to do that. This is Synth Dreams by Tim Crouch. Enjoy, and I will see you all next time. Thank you.